I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Chip Conley is celebrating his 20th anniversary as founder and CEO of California's largest boutique hotel company, Joie de Vie Hospitality. But his is not a business story about uninterrupted success. Instead, at a low point, he turned to Maslow's hierarchy of needs to guide him as a CEO, and he's sharing what he learned in his book, Peak, How Great Companies Get Their Mojo from Maslow. Also with us is Alan Krogan, Chief Probation Officer with the Riverside County, California Probation Department. We talked to him about how to reduce the number of men and women in our prisons and still keep our streets safe. We'll return with this week's edition of Smart City right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Chip Conley is the founder and CEO of Joie de Vie Hospitality, California's largest boutique hotel company, now celebrating its 20th anniversary. His most recent book is Peak, How Great Companies Get Their Mojo from Maslow. Chip is also recognized as a committed and creative philanthropist. He's founder of San Francisco's annual Celebrity Pool Toss, which has raised more than $3 million for inner-city youth programs now thriving in the troubled neighborhood where he launched his first hotel. Chip, what was your first impulse that led you into the hotel business?
Well, I grew up near Disneyland, and I always liked the Disneyland Hotel in Southern California. But I don't know if that was my first impulse, but when I was in college at Stanford University and then Stanford Business School, I was very focused on commercial real estate development, and my first 2 years out of business school, that's what I focused on, but I was actually sort of bored with it. I wasn't creative enough, and I was missing the idea that I wanted to create make people happy. Generally speaking, when you're a commercial real estate developer, you're negotiating all the time. As a hotelier, we rarely are negotiating about our rates at the front desk with our guests. So generally speaking, we're in the business of making people feel happy, and it seemed like the kind of business that I would appreciate being in. And at the young age of 25 or 26 years old, I bought my first hotel and was off to the races.
When you started your hotel, what became a hotel chain, and you bought your first hotel, were you thinking about it as place-based? Did you think about it as part of a neighborhood, as part of a place, or did the place not matter so much?
Well, the place matters a whole lot, and I was seeing that early on, and I believe it even more now, almost 21 years later. The hotels are really a reflection of the community that they're in, especially when they're independent hotels or boutique hotels. If they're a chain hotel, frankly, they can, you know, to some degree, the Sheraton in Kansas City is a lot like the Sheraton in Dallas. But in the boutique hotel world, or when you're creating independent hotels, they really are a reflection of the community. And in many cases, if you get it right, they become the local favorite. So the locals may not actually stay in the hotel, although they may eat at the restaurant or hang out at the bar, but they certainly make recommendations to friends and family and business associates coming to town as to where to stay. And so, yes, my first hotel was actually in a bad neighborhood here in San Francisco called the Tenderloin. And so while we didn't necessarily want to reflect the neighborhood, we certainly did a lot to actually connect with the neighborhood and do an awful lot of positive community spirited things to help make the neighborhood a better place.
What makes your hotels distinctive?
Well, you know, one thing I hear over the years, we have almost 40 hotels now, and we're the second largest boutique hotelier in the U.S., and what I hear a lot is they just feel different, they don't just look different. And what I think I would say that suggesting is that there's, it's not just a visual thing. A lot of times people go to a slick, hip, stylish boutique hotel, and it may look different, but it doesn't necessarily feel different, or it actually doesn't feel very good. And I think the fact that we do an awful lot of depth of training with our staff and create an environment where the staff feels quite involved in running the hotel and creating a strategic plan for the hotel means that there's people take ownership at whether you're a bellman or you're a housekeeper or you're a bartender. I think people sort of take ownership of being an entrepreneur as part of the enterprise. But I also think that the fact is the hotels are very creative, and each one has its own personality, and because each one's sort of an original, like a, you know, it's like we're a painter who takes a canvas off the wall and paints. So each one's an original. I think people appreciate that too.
And where does that personality come from? Does it come from you? Does it come from the designer? Does it come from the neighborhood, the community the hotel resides in? Where, and 40 hotels, that's a lot of personalities to keep up with. How do you do that?
Well, our organizing principle, which we started 21 years ago with the first hotel called the Phoenix, which is a rock and roll hotel, has been the same. And it's every time we create a hotel, it's based upon a particular magazine. And what I mean by that is we use a magazine as the touchstone for the personality of the hotel we're going to create. So that first hotel, the Phoenix, was based upon Rolling Stone magazine 21 years ago. And we came up with 5 words that define Rolling Stone, which were funky, cool, young at heart, irreverent, and adventurous. And everything we had to do in creating that hotel, from the style of the rooms, to the kind of art we chose, to the kind of staff we hired, to the unique services and amenities we would offer, all of them had to come back to sort of that checklist. What we've learned over time that's been somewhat miraculous is, first of all, it's been a great organizing principle to create unique hotels and make sure everybody on our team is on the same page about the personality that we're trying to create. But what's been particularly interesting is to see that the people who fall in love with the hotel are people who would use those 5 words to describe themselves. So it's almost like the little brand of one, the hotel brand of one we're creating, is a mirror for the aspirations of the customer. And whether it's our Hotel Rex, which is based upon New Yorker and is clever, literate, artistic, worldly, and sophisticated, or our Hotel Vitality, which is actually a hybrid of 2 magazines, Dwell Magazine meets Real Simple, and is modern, urbane, fresh, natural, and nurturing. Each of our hotels has a specific personality that actually somehow reflects a psychographic of somebody out there in the world. And psychographic is sort of like what's happening on the inside of us, not just our demographic on the outside. And by doing that, we're connecting with our customers almost on an emotional level, and it's part of the reason why our repeat customer numbers are way off the charts, much higher than our competition.
Have you ever thought about reversing the process and starting a magazine?
You know, I love magazines, so I'm a big fan of magazines. So there was a time in my life where I thought I wanted to go into that business, but that business is even harder than the hospitality business. It's a tough business. So no, we have actually created magazines for some of our hotels, and we actually have a Joie de Vivre magazine for all of our hotels that actually goes into the guest rooms.
Ah. In your new book, Peak, How Great Companies Get Their Mojo from Maslow, I love the name, you write that using Maslow's hierarchy of needs can help companies deepen their relationships with their customers, their employees, their investors. First, describe that hierarchy of needs for those who aren't familiar with it, and then describe how companies, in fact, can use that to deepen those relationships.
Sure. Abraham Maslow was a mid-20th century psychologist who became pretty famous. And he looked at psychology from a different perspective than Freud or Skinner or some of the well-known earlier psychologists of the world, psychiatrists of the world. He basically said, why are we studying people who are unhappy to define the human condition? In essence, what he was saying is that psychologists and psychiatrists had studied what he would call worst practices and in terms of people who are not happy or healthy or not fulfilled. And then from that, studying those people, the psychology community would actually define the human condition. He said, let's study best practices. Let's study people who are happy and fulfilled have made something of their lives that they're really excited about, and let's try to define a human condition based upon that. He came up with something called the hierarchy of needs, which is sort of famous. It's a pyramid with 5 levels, and the 5 levels, the basic premise is that people have basic needs, survival needs, so to speak, that are physiological needs at the base of the pyramid, and 1 level above that, safety needs. People have those as their basic needs. If those needs aren't being met, they can't move up the pyramid to more interesting and, you know, sort of almost sort of more fulfilling kind of things higher up the pyramid. But once you get those sort of survival needs partially met, you sort of move up the pyramid. So you have physiological needs, safety needs. The 3rd level is social belonging needs. The 4th level is esteem needs. And the fifth level is what he called self-actualization. And the best way for me to describe self-actualization is what the U.S. Army had for its advertising campaign for 15 years, which was be all that you can be. And they got that from Maslow. And it's based upon the premise that, you know, you're here on Earth for a reason, and trying to figure out what that reason is and what your calling is what we're here to do. And once you've found that, you're a very lucky person, because most people don't find it.
And then how does business use that to deepen key relationships?
Thank you. The way we found it to work, and again, we did this, we came up with this in the midst of the biggest downturn since World War II in the hotel business. And we were here in the Bay Area, which is the area of the country that got hit the worst. So what we found is we took the five levels of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and we really turned it into three levels, the base level being survival, the middle level being sort of succeed, and the top level being transformation. And we said, how do we actually create survival needs, or adjust the survival needs for our employees, our customers, and investors, and then their succeed needs, and then their transformation needs? So let me use a quick example. For the employee, the basic survival need for employees is money, compensation package. But the reality is, if a company actually says that the primary reason that an employee stays in their job is purely because of money, they got it wrong. And almost all surveys show that's usually like fourth place in terms of the why a person would leave a job. And frankly, if you create a company that's based upon the idea that it's all about bribing your employees, and if you're the highest paying employer, the moment someone comes along and pays them 5% more, they're going to leave. So it doesn't create loyalty. So money is at the base of the pyramid. Recognition is in the middle of the pyramid. That's the success need. Those are the sort of the social belonging and esteem needs of an employee. And that creates loyalty. People, number one reason people leave their job is because of their direct supervisor. So people actually join companies, but they leave their boss. But that's the second part of the pyramid. But the top of the pyramid, the person who's sort of living out their calling and is inspired by what they do, generally speaking, is in a place where they have a sense of meaning in what they do every day or what the company or organization does. And if you can actually elevate your employees from money to recognition to meaning, that hierarchy, you're moving them up from job to career to calling. And that's ultimately, we have 3,000 employees now, and 1,200 of them actually clean toilets for a living. And part of my job and part of our team in my company's job is to actually move those housekeepers up from just feeling like cleaning a toilet is a job to feeling like it's actually a calling.
And how do you do that?
How do you do that? It's a good question, because it sounds like a lot of great words, but we do it. We have the book Peak has a lot of exercises around this, but let me use one particular one. In studying nurses out there in the world, there's been some interesting studies done that show that when nurses actually see that they are a patient advocate, as opposed to the person who has a syringe that's going to give you pain, it completely changes the perspective on a daily basis of how the nurse approaches their work and how they feel about it. So we had to sort of take that same perspective with our housekeeping staff, move them from being toilet cleaners to help them feel like they're serenity creators or tranquility creators. So we did one exercise with our housekeeping staff is we had 8 of them at a table, and again, most of them, frankly, speak English as a second language, so it was a matter of really getting them to understand it was okay to share and to speak, you know, in English, you know, not in full sentences, but just to say what they had on their mind. And we had a facilitator at each table, and the facilitator asked them, if you had a guest come to the hotel and they didn't know that you were a housekeeper, but they just saw what you did for them, what would they call you? And sort of an abstract question. But, you know, we would do some earlier questions first that got them up to this point. And the housekeeper would say, well, I guess they'd see me as sort of like the mom away from home. It's like we're like mom. We're cleaning up for you when you leave your room. Or we're the serenity sisters. We're creating sort of a sense of serenity and tranquility so when you come back. Or we're the clutter busters. And so they started to come up with these interesting ways to describe themselves. Not so much for the task of what they were doing, but more for the purpose and impact that they were having on our customer. And then we actually had some of our customers actually literally come into these meetings and sit down and talk with our housekeeping staff about positive experiences that they've had staying in our hotels around the housekeeping staff. You know, and some of these are specific anecdotes where someone comes back to their room after a really difficult day of negotiations, and they just thought that that the housekeeping staff had done some things beyond just the normal things to make their room feel completely like a place of peace of mind and a place of tranquility. So when you start to actually get your staff to start thinking of what they do more for the purpose of it and the impact than the task, you're helping them move from job to calling.
And translate that then for me, Chip, to customers. How do you deliver transformative experiences to customers in your business?
Well, this is one of the fun parts of the book to write, because I really went out and studied some, what I would call transformative peak performing companies, from Harley Davidson to Apple to Whole Foods Market to Southwest Airlines. And what I found was that the companies that do this well, that are really creating evangelistic customers who want, who love to talk about the company, are companies that, generally speaking, get the base of the pyramid right, which is the survival need of a customer. The survival need of a customer is really just having their expectations met. There's a great quote I love, which is, "Disappointment is the natural result of badly managed expectations." Disappointment is the natural result of badly managed expectations. That's true of when you buy a car and you have buyer's remorse a week later. It could be true of your honeymoon. If you had a certain expectation and it wasn't lived out in the honeymoon, there you go. That's someone who did not have their expectations met, and they have disappointment as a result. So companies that actually focus on expectations, that's the base of the pyramid. The problem is that American business 30 years ago could just, you know, Ford or General Motors or Sears or JCPenney's could just sort of deliver that basic customer satisfaction at the base of the pyramid, and that was good enough for them to beat the competition. That ain't true today, because the internet has really sort of leveled the playing field and created what I call a promiscuous consumer. And what that means is that this consumer can really go out and, you know, find anything else. There's not as much brand loyalty as there used to be. So the level above that is meeting desires. So if the base of the survival need is meeting the expectations of the customer, the next level above that, the succeed need for the customer, is meeting their desires. And the companies that do this really well tend to be very good at either technology or training or both. Amazon and Netflix are really good at meeting desires, because frankly, their technology keeps track of what I'm interested in. So if I'm going to the internet and I like to buy books on Abraham Maslow, and there's a new Maslow book coming out next year, guess what? Amazon's going to tell me about it, because they know my desires. Similarly, some of the best companies in the world for service are companies that have great training. Four Seasons is an example I like to use, because they have just an amazing training program. So if I go stay in a particular Four Seasons two or three times, by the third or fourth time I'm there, they know me really well. They know my desires well, and they're able to deliver on those. And that's what creates customer commitment. So customers aren't necessarily committed when they just have their expectations met, because all that does is deliver customer satisfaction. But when you have your desires met, it actually delivers that sense of customer commitment. The top of that pyramid, the peak of the customer pyramid, is those companies that deliver on the unexpected needs, meaning the unexpected, or I'm sorry, the unrecognized needs of a customer. So what is an unrecognized need? Well, let's think back many years ago when Citibank was the company that actually delivered ATMs to the world. Now, prior to ATMs coming around, no customer had said, well, I want this contraption to be, you know, on the side of my bank and spitting out money to me based upon the card I put in. I mean, it was sort of like, wow, are you kidding? Somebody can actually do that? Customers don't usually come up with the things at the peak of the pyramid. Usually it's the company figuring out what the customer would really appreciate but hasn't asked for. For example, Sony Walkman, if they had gotten it right, they would have created the iPod. But it was Apple that created the iPod. And Sony did not listen to their customers. They would listen to their customers, but their customers didn't say, well, I want the Walkman to morph into an iPod someday. So the unrecognized need of the customer was met by Apple. Or Federal Express, when Fred Smith started that company, overnight package delivery was like an unrecognized need and something that a customer didn't even know could exist. But they delivered on it. Interestingly enough, 10 years later, that company was in trouble because that had become a commodity. And what Fred Smith said was, I thought I was in the business of transporting goods, and I came to realize I was in the business of creating peace of mind. And that's when he created the logistics tracking system for FedEx packages, which was another unrecognized need of the customers, and all of a sudden got them to grow market share again. So that's the customer pyramid.
And how have you used the customer pyramid and met unrecognized needs in the hotel business?
I'll give you a brief example. If you go to the Joie de Vivre Hotels website, which is jdvhotels.com, you'll see on the homepage a character named Yvette the Hotel Matchmaker. What Yvette does is she gives you a one-minute personality test. I don't know any other hotel company that does this. And she gives you a one-minute personality test, asks five questions that helps us understand a little bit more about your personality and your psychographic, identity. And what we serve back to you then, after this one-minute test, is the five hotels in our collection that best fit your personality. Because as you recall from earlier in this conversation, each of our hotels has a unique personality and identity and creates sort of a mirror for the aspirations of our customers. So it's a really cool and fun tool to connect people with our hotels in a way that fits their personality and their habitat that they'd like to be in. But more importantly, and the unrecognized need here, is the fact that what we also serve back to our guests is a bunch of content of things to do in the area here that fit your personality and your interests. So instead of going out and getting a Frommer's guidebook that's written generically for all of us, as opposed to it being customized specifically for us, what we're creating is the opportunity for one of our guests to say, wow, I have this kind of personality, and that hotel company not only connected me to the right hotels, but to a collection of things to do that are appropriate for me only and only me, or for me and people like me, as opposed to, 98% of the rest of the population.
Mm-hmm.
So by doing that, what we're doing is we're creating a really an amazing experience, and less of a commodity experience than what you'd have if you were going to Expedia or Hotels.com to book your hotel.
You write about turning customers into evangelists. How do you do that?
Personally?
Yeah.
The number one thing, if I can give the best piece of advice I can ever give on service, is to respond quickly. Now, no company is ever going to get everything right, or no person will. But so the question is, how do you do service recovery? And I get, we have 4,000 hotel rooms, and so we have lots of people staying in our hotels every night. So I get emails and calls occasionally. The worst thing I can do is to pass it to someone else or to not be responsive at all. So the fact that I drop everything, if I see an email that comes in or a phone call that comes in that someone's upset, I really do drop just about everything. And within 10 to 20 minutes, I try to respond. If nothing else, to say, I hear you. I'm really sorry about what I've heard, what you're telling me. And let me go ahead and do a little bit of investigation on this. And I will get back to you, or somebody on my team will get back to you to find out and to try to respond to you. And then I'll go to the hotel where there's a problem, for example, and sort of say, tell me more about this. Can you actually respond to this guest who's in-house right now or had an experience a week ago? And we respond quickly. Because the fact is, we can't do everything perfectly, but if we respond quickly, all of a sudden we've shown the person that they're important enough that we care to actually be responsive. But secondly, we've actually, when someone's had a bad experience, they become what I call a terrorist. And I don't mean that to be anything like literally a terrorist, like bombing buildings, but I mean that they are going out and telling the world that we're terrible hotel operators. So the sooner we actually get them turned around, the better it is for us.
Chip Conley is founder and CEO of Joie de Vivre Hospitality, and his most recent book is Peak, How Great Companies Get Their Mojo from Maslow. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planetizen assistant editor Nate Berg.
Light rail has been a contentious issue in Kansas City for the past year. Voters approved a plan for a light rail system back in November, but city officials say it's not a realistic blueprint. Though many in the city want the system, there is very little consensus on its details. From its location, to its extent, to its funding sources, there are many divergent ideas. And now there's an even more divergent idea. The Kansas City Star recently reported that city council members are now looking into the possibility of ditching the light rail plans and tunneling a full-on subway beneath the city. Officials are planning to meet with engineers to discuss the feasibility of tunneling through the limestone on which the city stands. Light rail proponents are dismissing this idea, but a project manager on the Kansas City Area Transportation Authority's light rail study team says a subway system might cost only a little more than a light rail system. After the city repealed the voter-approved light rail plan, it promised to have a revised version of the proposal on the ballot by November 2008. But now the subway idea is in the ether and more in-depth analysis is scheduled to begin in January. Depending on the outcome, the light rail initiative planned for the November 2008 ballot may have to be edited. Meanwhile, in central New York, the small college town of Aurora recently underwent a five-year, $40 million renovation and revitalization effort that restored historic homes and brought new life into a struggling downtown area. This all sounds nice, but it has made many residents of this small town fuming mad. The New York Times reports that residents are saying the renovation effort has turned their town into a dollhouse, with overly cutesy restorations that don't mesh with the historic character of the town. This dollhouse comparison is appropriate, at least for the fact that the benefactor responsible for the renovation is the founder of a doll company called American Girl. She is also a graduate of Wells College in Aurora, which called out to her when enrollment started to sag a few years back. After the renovation, enrollment at Wells is back up and the downtown area is thriving. Many other local establishments are also booming, but residents say they are booming in a bad way. The businesses may be successful in their newer, classier forms, but for longtime residents, this renovation has destroyed the small-town character of their community. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll talk with Alan Krogan in Riverside, California, about how to rethink our strategies for keeping our cities safe. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Alan Krogan is chief probation officer with the Riverside County, California Probation Department. He has a long career in community corrections in California, having served 17 years as chief probation officer in San Diego County and Santa Barbara County before coming to Riverside. He is past president of Chief Probation Officers of California. Alan, what is the role of probation in our current justice system, particularly as it relates to drug offenders?
Well, the primary role of the probation departments in the state of California is that we're the most multifaceted law enforcement agency in the counties, in that we have responsibility for all juveniles and adults that are ordered by the court to be supervised, and even to the point that we run detention facilities for juveniles, we run treatment facilities for male and female juveniles. Some counties actually had institutions for adult males, and some have work furloughs, which basically handle males and females. So the responsibility is, its primary responsibility is serving the court and serving the community. And the focus on drug offenders, regretfully, it is so large in the corrections field that approximately 80% of adults and juveniles that are placed on probation have a substance abuse history. They may be actively participating in substance abuse or alcohol, or have at some point in their life were seriously involved in the use and abuse of substances.
Yow, that's huge. So, in your opinion, and you're experienced and have observed drug offenders and substance abusers up close, I mean, is it the substance abuse that leads to the crime, or is it just all part of a interwoven complex package?
It's both. And quite often, those that are involved in substance abuse, crime is their mode of maintaining their abuse. Mm-hmm. Others get involved in substance abuse and they just enjoy it, and it's a byproduct of their environment that they're in. At one point, we did a survey of juveniles detained in our juvenile hall, and we did it on a weekend. And what we did was we interviewed over a span of about 8 weeks every weekend for booking, because that's your highest period of booking. Is we asked them what type of drugs they used, when they got started, and who was the person behind their involvement in substance abuse.
Great questions.
The youngest started when he was 9. The average started when they were 12. The substance abuse of choice in Riverside has been marijuana and methamphetamine. Methamphetamine is the poor man's cocaine. The third area, which was staggering for me, is their first involvement with substance abuse was through a parent or a relative that provided them with the substance. That's staggering. And then when you throw in the fact that the average age is 12, that they became involved in substance abuse is even, it's that reaches on being tragic.
Well, it does. And I'm curious, as a public official, once you understand that a parent or relative was most likely to be involved with the beginning of substance taking by 12-year-olds on average, you know, don't you begin to question who becomes a parent, who's allowed to keep their children? I mean, what are we doing here?
Well, the reality is that society has reached a point where substance abuse is in my estimate, prolific. When you have 80 to 90% of your adults arrested and booked into county jail, they're under the influence of drugs or alcohol at the time of booking. When I'm running 80% of every juvenile detained in juvenile hall with a substance abuse history, our treatment programs are probably 100% have had some serious abuse of drugs or alcohol, and that's provided by a family member. It's chaotic. And you know, how do we get it back under control? One big part of it is education, you know, making people aware. Early recognition that substance abuse is a problem. And schools will tell you that they can point out who will be a problem child in the education system by the students by the time they reach the third grade. They're going to have learning disabilities. They're going to have acting out behavior. Well, the same capacity exists, but how do you get access to that attention? One of the ways we're doing it here in Riverside is we have youth accountability teams that are assigned to middle schools. And what we do when the teachers are having problems with certain individuals, whether it's acting out in the classroom, a battery, vandalism, substance abuse, under the influence, we become involved immediately. It's step one, and then get the family involved. So the fact that we are intervening at an early age, basically middle schools, we are, I feel, abating some future individuals that are going to be moving into the higher level of substance abuse, chronic substance abuse, and that's what I mean by higher level, and committing crimes.
So walk me through a scenario with a middle school child acting out. They're probably ready to at least suspend him or her, if not expel them. Well, what happens? How do you get involved? How do you get the call? Who calls you? And then what do you do?
What we have done is we've assigned staff to a group of schools. So we will say that school A, B, and C are assigned to me. Then what I have, the schools have direct access to me. They have a problem on campus. They call me. I come to the campus. Then we get involved in whatever the issue is, whether it is gang issues, whether it's vandalism, whether it's drugs, or whether it's assault of behavior, battery. And then the key thing at that age is that you get the family involved immediately. You get the mother and the father, if they have both, or whoever adult that is responsible for that home environment. You get them involved, and you put up quality resources. If you have a person acting out in a violent way, you get into anger management issues, but you do it with the whole family, because generally they are not a single child families. We see very few of those. They are multiple children. They have adult children that the kid is looking up to because he is a thug. He's a gangbanger, and Junior wants to be like him. The brother is the one that's been providing him with marijuana. So you have to deal with the entire family. It's what we call a holistic approach. You're dealing with the whole family. And that's the only way you're really going to focus on it.
But if parents or relatives have been involved in the start of use of substances, illegal substances, then I presume, I mean, you don't have families necessarily sitting back wringing their hands over the bad behavior of their children. I mean, in many ways, if you believe your numbers, I mean, they're contributing to it. I mean, so is part of getting the family involved, helping families understand their own I mean, their own contributions to the problem?
Quite often, that's exactly what happens. You actually end up finding out that the mother is the drug addict, and she has basically abdicated any responsibility for that kid's behavior because of her own addiction. And she's not much of a functioning parent anyways. And so the junior now has become this defiant, acting out, supposedly acting as an adult because he has no adult figure in his home. And if you deal with it as a whole and you focus on the mother of getting her stabilized as well as the son, and then dealing with, you know, the reality of parenting skills. You know, Carol, so many of these families that we deal with, this child was not planned. This was not a united effort between two people to create a family that they were going to love for the rest of their life and nurture and help educate. Quite often we're dealing with a population that is unwanted. And the parent, although they gave birth to the child, it was a byproduct of the act they were involved in, not in a desire to have a child. And so you're dealing with people that do not have parenting skills, really didn't want to be a parent, and so they're abusive. They're not responsible. And when I say abusive, I mean physically, mentally, in some cases sexually abusive. And so you've walked into a black hole of needs, in that they haven't had structure and haven't had discipline. And small as this may sound, they don't even have a wholesome nutritional diet that they're involved in, because they don't cook or bake or have an organized dinner or breakfast on the weekends. I mean, it's absolutely some of the most disjointed environments you would ever want to see.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Alan Krogan. He's Chief Probation Officer with the Riverside County, California Probation Department. Well, how do you deal with that? I mean, that, again, disjointed, dysfunctional in every way. I mean, how do you come? I'm curious, number one, how do you keep from feeling overwhelmed? And second, I guess, how do you have enough resources and the range of resources to deal with the problems you're walking into?
The question you just asked is the answer is basically funding. You train staff to deal with this population. First of all, staff apply to work in this environment, and they know what they're walking into. And quite often they've educated themselves either through psychology or sociology or different types of social sciences. And law enforcement, and they want to work in this environment, because they feel they can make a difference. How do you get the resources to do it? That is a constant challenge. With budgets being what they are, and the state not being able to even balance its own budget, then they have a tendency to go back to the counties and balance the state budget off of the county's back. Then the county has to react and reduce. And what do? You go into programs and you cut them. Because a lot of these programs, they're expensive, because you're bringing in higher levels of professionals, such as a lot of these dysfunctional families. We're seeing greater levels of mental health issues. As a matter of fact, I would say when I started in the field 34 years ago, and I started working in a juvenile hall, we may have had one out of a population, the facility could hold 250, one that had a mental health issue and needed to be involved in crisis counseling. Today, I'll just use Riverside Juvenile Hall, which is one of three that I have, which has a bed capacity of 193. I have 47 that are on psychotropic medications.
Why? Why the increase? Why the increase, Alan?
Because we've turned into mental health programs, because mental health services have been cut back over the years. Of previous, you know, California administrations have basically said, we're not going to pay for mental health services because it's an endless pit. we keep building facilities and there's more of them. And that's what you see in your homeless population.
All right. Tell me something. It feels very overwhelming. It feels, we don't have enough money. We don't have enough services. We're cutting back in some areas to, you know, kidding ourselves that we're saving money, but it's costing us in others. So here's a question. If you were governor of the state of California, where would you invest money to get out of this revolving door problem we have and begin to make some real dents in the problem based on what you've seen, based on what you know?
The California has the largest penal system in the country. There are 172,000 inmates confined in 34 prisons in the state of California. About 10 years ago, I was working with a California legislator and went to Senator Dede Albert, who's a wonderful, wonderful lady and a very creative legislator. And at that time, the State Department of Corrections budget was at about $5.6 billion to house the inmate population, which at that time was probably in the 140,000 range 10 years ago. Today, the state budget for the Department of Corrections, I believe, is $9.2 billion. 172,000 inmates, of which 14,000 are lifers. And of that, about 4,000 are life without possibility of parole, and there's about 700 on death row in California. My suggestion is that with those kinds of staggering dollars, give me one penny for every dollar, and you let probation departments, in conjunction with schools, in conjunction with mental health, in conjunction with alcohol and drug services in the counties, and we will take that one penny per dollar, and we will start after-school programs. We will put people in the elementary schools to spot the one that's acting out in the third grade. We will get involved in the parents. We'll get involved in parent effectiveness training. We'll get involved in the gang issues. Carol, you can spot a future gangbanger by at least age 8, maybe age 9 at the latest. They're starting to sag. They've got the right haircut. They've got the walk. They've got the language. They're working on becoming a gang member.
All right, so that's my calculation is 1% is $92 million. Do you know what's spent on those services today in California?
You'd have to take every county and evaluate what they're doing. I have an $86 million budget, and on the prevention side, I would say I spend, because I have institutions and institutions are expensive, half of the budget is eaten up in staff cost and services and supplies in the institution. I would say I'm probably at about 3%.
Are there things we should be doing in prisons today, are not doing in prisons today that you think would make a difference in terms of, you know, once someone's out on the street, you know, how do the rest of us fare?
Well, the first part of the answer would be what works is early intervention. The quicker you get to the issues at hand and deal with them, the greater success you're going to have. I mean, it's as simple as dealing with an illness. If you diagnose it and start treatment at the earliest stage possible, the chances of curing are very, very high. The prison system, Carol, they're out of control. Absolutely out of control. And regretfully, the scenario you painted is you couldn't have painted it any better. Society got fed up. They got sick and tired of being preyed on, being victimized. But they also got duped. What happens in California, most legislation is now successful through initiatives or propositions. Legislators are no longer lawmakers in California. They don't sit down and debate the issues and make decisions as we thought they were going to when they went to the legislature. So what they do is they put things on the ballot, and they always start an initiative out with the lead paragraph. Then they never tell you how that paragraph's going to work, but they lead it in with just exactly what you said. Are you fed up with being victimized? Do you feel murderers and rapists who commit crimes at age 15, 16 should have the ability to be released before they're 21 years of age? No. Most people are going to say, absolutely not. Let me sign it. But what they don't go on to tell you is that the current system wasn't broke. It was a great system. And what it did was is it left the decision in the hands of the judiciary, the judges, and the prosecutors on what cases were going to be filed in what manner. Now, this is a true example. I have a juvenile in one of my detention facilities right now. He was 14 and 10 months old, very immature at the time, uneducated, in a home that was all the negative things that you want to throw into the home, it had. He goes out with the boys, older brother and his buddies. They commit a gang rape. He did not participate in the rape in the sense of having the sexual intercourse. He did participate in holding down one of her arms. He was 14 years, 11 months. He had no prior record other than some vandalism and some, I think there was some possession of alcohol. This kid will never see the light of day until he's at least 35 or 36 years of age. So he will have been locked up for 23, 24 years. He has put on he's 7 inches taller. He's going to turn 18 in, I think it's February. He's put on 65 pounds. He is a junior counselor in the institution. He is one of the peer counselors, as we call them. And he basically helps new kids that are brought in. But what happened there was the legislature wouldn't make a law. They wrote a paragraph that was very emotional and very strong. Then they never tell you how it's going to be implemented, and you vote for it. And our public has been duped with legislation like that. And Prop 36 is another example, which is the don't send drug offenders to state prison, which is a bunch of bull. It's not that you need to send them to state prison. You have to hold them accountable, and Prop 36 does not allow you to hold them accountable. So that's a combination of answers. You have to have early intervention. You've got to spot the problem at the roots and then deal with it.
Alan Krogan is Chief Probation Officer with the Riverside County, California Probation Department. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith asks us not to give up on baby boomers.
Don't give up on baby boomers. They may be aging, but it's the boomer approach to aging that matters, not the number of candles on their birthday cakes. Youthfulness, impact, and possibility are the cornerstones of the aging boomer mindset that is best summarized by the title of our new book about this cohort, Generation Ageless. Boomers are remaking what it means to get older, thus revolutionizing the notion of aging itself. Fresh research reported in our book shows universal agreement among aging boomers about remaining actively engaged with life. 97% agree it is important to, quote-unquote, maintain a youthful spirit about life. 92% see, quote-unquote, no reason why young people and older people can't enjoy the same kinds of things. 89% do not believe, quote-unquote, you have to feel less vital and energetic as you get older, and the same percentage believe that, quote-unquote, in the future, older people will be much more active and engaged than older people in the past. This is not wishful thinking. Medical advances and higher standards of living will offer boomers a healthier, more vigorous old age. It's easy to satirize this ageless sensibility, yet only by ridiculing boomers for not conforming to old age stereotypes. But who's the bigger fool here? Those defying the stereotypes or those doing the stereotyping? Combine this energetic mindset with the size of the boomer cohort, and the result is a group ignored at one's peril. Hands down, boomers have the numbers. Younger generations are simply not big enough for boomers not to matter most. Boomers are the 78 million strong product of a 19-year exception to the 100-year-plus decline in U.S. fertility rates that began in the late 19th century. Boomers didn't invent the sexual revolution. They are its offspring, the aptly described pig in the python. Boomers also have far more money and influence than trailing generations, advantages they will continue to enjoy for the foreseeable future. Boomers are an enduring, overwhelming presence. It is myopic to overlook them. Unfortunately, this is standard practice. Doing more to appeal to boomers does not mean doing the same old things. Not only will boomers be different than old people in years past, they will be different than they themselves were in years past. Boomers have moved beyond novelty for its own sake, but remain just as interested in innovation and originality as today's 20-somethings. In the boomer survey completed for our book, Generation Ageless, the median response to the question of the age at which someone is too old to start anything, quote-unquote, new and innovative, was 86.6. Boomers will engage with life to the fullest extent they are able. The limiting factor is not interest or energy, it's the dearth of opportunities. Diminishing interest in what's available today mask an undiminished interest in what could and should be available tomorrow to satisfy the aspirations of ageless boomers. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. And his most recent book is about baby boomers, and he calls it Generation Ageless. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.